first case for argument is Messman v. Crane. Mr. Allen.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Kenneth Allen for John Messman. Applying the open and obvious danger rule, a rule rendered obsolete by a trilogy of Indiana Supreme Court cases handed down in 1990, and by amendments to the Indiana Products Liability Act subsequent to that, the district court gutted John Messman's product liability case and scrapped a reasonable jury's verdict.
Mr. Allen, forgive me for starting like this, but just to clarify something for myself, as I understand it, your claims of design defect aren't claims based on common law negligence, but rather strict liability claims under the Indiana Product Liability Act.
Your Honor is correct. Okay. And I think to understand how the district court went awry in this case, we first need to understand three fundamental principles of safety engineering: hazard, risk, and danger. Allow me to define those. Hazard is a condition or set of circumstances which poses a hazard or a danger.
You had bad experts.
Well,
why didn't your engineer go to the plant?
He tried to, and he was turned away.
Well, really? You mean you couldn't have gotten an order so that he could inspect the premises?
Your Honor, I think the significant point.
Would you answer that?
Well, at that point, it wasn't important. What was important?
Well, I don't understand why it isn't important that he be able to see. It seems to me your case is that given the tightness of the dimensions in this plant, Crane did not design its crane in a way that recognized the dangers posed by the tightness. That's really your case, isn't it?
With due respect,
are
Your
you
Honor,
trying to
it is
overhaul
not.
The whole crane industry?
With due respect, Your Honor, we are not. First of all, your question as to the expert, you need to know that in the record was a videotape of the entire plant, the proceedings, the lifting procedure, the cranes,
video,
and so forth.
Look, photography and your pictures, we know photography can be extremely misleading.
No, this was a videotape that was in the
record. I know it can, but it can be extremely misleading. It depends on the angle. You don't see dimensions clearly. I don't understand why a responsible expert would not insist on seeing the premises when it's precisely the condition of the premises, the dimensions, the clearance between the boxcar and the cab that seemed to me to be critical to your case.
Here's why it isn't, Your Honor. A hazard is a condition or a changing set of circumstances that poses a danger. That's the first principle.
But
Second principle is risk.
The gravity of the hazard here depends on the distance between the boxcar's rim and the cab.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. Respectfully, if code would have been followed, the limit switch would have prevented
any hazard. If the cab and the boxcar rim had been farther apart, then this deceleration feature and this, you know, what you think is the clumsy character of the control, that would have been much less consequential because there would have been much less risk of the load hitting the cab.
Had reasonable engineering practices.
Isn't that true?
No.
You mean the dimensions didn't make any difference? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And may I explain why?
Sure, of course.
It wouldn't have had they followed reasonable engineering practices. Our expert, who is an electrical, control systems analyst, and a computer engineer, designs these things, worked for the crane manufacturers, says that you set the limit switch to eliminate the hazard. The first thing you do is eliminate the hazard if it can be designed out reasonably.
But there's no hazard if the cab is far enough away from the rim.
But it wasn't.
But that's the whole point I'm saying. It's the tightness.
No, you... You eliminate
suppose the cab were 100 feet above the rim of the boxcar. Then you wouldn't need a limit switch, right?
No. Code
no,
still
you
requires.
Still need a limit switch.
Yes. Code requires a limit switch.
What
to be
sense
set.
Does that make? Would you tell me?
The code requires it.
But there's nothing that it would hit if it's 100 feet up, right?
No, that's wrong. It could hit the bridge girder. It could hit a light on the bridge. It could hit any portion of the bridge, and that
depends
can cause
the
load to fall.
Is.
Pardon me?
Depends where the bridge is.
Well, okay, but that wasn't part of your hypothetical, respectfully. But the point is,
well, I'm right. adding it.
All right. If the bridge is 100 feet above the load,
right.
I respectfully submit that the bridge shouldn't be 100 feet. It should be on the ground. It should be a different kind of crane. You don't have an overhead crane 100 feet above the surface where the load is being lifted. But the point is, you eliminate the hazard simply by setting the switch that says the load can't be raised higher than that.
Isn't your sort of argument that Crane Pro set the crane to decelerate over a period of 3 seconds, which meant that the crane would continue to move for another 12 inches before stopping?
That's part of it, Your Honor. But Crane Pro did more than that to increase the risk that was already there, the hazard, I should say. The hazard was open and obvious to Crane Pro and to the workers that this could possibly hit and spill the load into the train car. But what was not open and obvious was the danger, because danger is the unreasonable or unacceptable exposure or a combination of risk and hazard. And risk implies the factors that this court has recited and the Indiana Supreme Court has recited: perception, appreciation, circumstances, anticipated knowledge of the and behavior of the users. Therefore,
what was the clearance between the rim of the boxcar and the cab?
The testimony was that there was about a foot between the height of the boxcar and the bridge cab. But that
are you talking about the top of the rail car and the bottom of the cab? That
yes.
was 12 inches.
Yes, about a foot.
Okay.
So the point is, though, Your Honor, not only did they increase this hazard, or this risk, I should say, the hazard's there, they increased the risk of this hazard causing harm by have the slow deceleration, but they also eliminated the ability of the operator to correct the problem once it hits. He no longer can lower the load immediately. That's how they dealt with it in the past.
But if it hadn't been a foot, if it had been 5 feet, it would have been much safer, right?
The point is,
and your unwillingness to deal with the facts of this case,
doesn't
it make a difference that it was 1 foot instead of 5 feet? Didn't that make it more dangerous?
Not if
did it make it more dangerous?
If
why are you resisting? I'm not arguing.
Well, allow me to say a sentence, and I'll tell you why. If reasonable engineering practices had been followed, Your Honor, then there wouldn't have there
would
wouldn't
you
make
just
a difference.
Answer my question. Did
yes.
it make it more dangerous that it was 1 foot rather than 5 feet?
Under these circumstances.
Did it make it more dangerous?
Under these circumstances, it did, but it shouldn't have. If reasonable engineering practices had been followed, it wouldn't have made a difference, because the limit switch would have prevented it from contacting the cab. That's my point. It
Why
did in this
you walk
case.
Away from a fact that's in your favor? That's what I don't understand.
No, my point is, in this case, Your Honor.
I don't understand you.
Well, I'm doing my best.
Why are you arguing
that
1 foot, given 1 foot clearance, which Crane knew, they should have realized they had to make additional safety measures beyond what they usually do?
Well,
why isn't that your case?
That's what I'm trying to say, Your Honor.
The slight clearance between the boxcar rim and the cab is irrelevant.
What I mean to say, please forgive me, what I mean to say is it should be irrelevant if reasonable engineering practices are followed, because the limit switch would prevent the contact. But because they weren't followed in this case, it was, as Your Honor suggests, very relevant.
Does it matter when there was an emergency stop switch that would have halted the load immediately?
No, Your Honor, because halting the load is not going to lower and level it. That is how they dealt with it before. If it hit the cab, they just lower it. And it would level. The testimony was it could tilt as much as 38 degrees before falling. So what happened was, the way this crane was designed, once he hit the stop button, he lost all control for 3 seconds, for a foot. He couldn't lower it. And that was precisely the problem here. That was what enhanced the risk. These workers didn't perceive this risk. The crane had been in use for 10 days. the operator had never unloaded train cars before. John Mesman was a hooker, or actually a machine operator. This wasn't his usual job. No plates had been dropped in the car before.
But he was trained in the new crane, wasn't he?
No. The crane operator, this new crane had been in existence or in operation for 10 days. The crane operator had never unloaded train cars before. He did testify that he felt comfortable with the control, but obviously that was a misperception on his part because he didn't understand he couldn't lower it once it struck the overhead obstruction. I would like to reserve the balance of my time, if I may, Your Honor. I apologize for not being as articulate as I should
be. Okay. No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Thank
Mr.
You.
Knight?
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. This case was decided by Judge Springman, not because I don't think of an argument over whether the open and obvious doctrine still applies in Indiana. Certainly it does. The plaintiff's reply at page 7, I think, makes a last-ditch effort to say that Judge Springman was confused by this doctrine as Indiana law applies it. And in their brief, they point out, or try to in the reply, that, well, you know, maybe there still is this doctrine in Indiana law, which we all know has never been abrogated.
I don't understand really what bearing that has on it. I mean, it does seem to me that because of the low clearance, this was very dangerous. They had to maneuver the load between the boxcar rim and the cab. There was very little space. So it was very easy to bump up against the cab. And then, as Judge Rovner said, you know, if you have this deceleration feature, which might be perfectly good in a more spacious setting, but in this very tight setting, it was dangerous. Not obvious that it felt like Van Til would perceive that danger clearly.
Well, there are a couple of issues with that. That distance, whatever it might be, never changed with our renovation. That's number one.
I don't see what difference that makes. You could have removed the cab as part of your renovation.
Judge Moody
wasn't being used for anything.
Judge Moody ruled early on, clearly in a summary judgment, that we had no duty to remove that cab.
I don't understand that. You're in here. You're building this crane. You know, it's sort of a custom deal, and because of the presence of the cab, it's dangerous. So you could just have removed the cab. Why wouldn't that be a safety precaution, like the limit switch or the instant deceleration or something like that? I mean, why couldn't a jury find that, you know, you were careless in not realizing that these very tight dimensions made this unusually dangerous?
The type of controller that was used is common in the industry.
It may be common, but that doesn't mean that it fits every situation. I mean, that's what seems to me to be missing in the analysis here. Your safety precautions might be fine in the average steel plant, but because of this cab sticking there in the way, you should have made some adjustments.
That ability, I guess, for lack of a better description, the ability or the ability for an operator to steer a load into the cab didn't change with our controls.
Well, here's what the absence of a limiting switch that would have prevented contact with the cab. Why isn't that arguably a defect, given that an operator who is stationed in the rail car with the load can't see as readily how close the load is to the cab, and at the same time, that operator has his attention divided among several different tasks.
In this particular case, Van Til testified that he was on a stack of plates that put him essentially eye level with the bottom of the cab. The danger posed that everybody testified to was that a spreader beam used by InfraMetals to actually pick up the load, having nothing to do with Crane Pro. The spreader beam is a bar that holds the hooks that hold the load. It's the spreader beam that they're saying should have been made made it impossible to contact the bottom of the cab. Well, we know it could always happen before. We also know that there are 10, 20, 30-foot spreader beams. What plaintiff's expert failed to take into account was the absence of any proof that if somebody, in fact, limited the ability for that spreader beam to get high enough to unload these plates of steel, well, if we had limited it to keep the spreader beam below the bottom of the cab, there's no proof at all as to whether or not they could have unloaded this rail car, period. That's why I think, and the case law supports, that at some point with a product, you have to assume that the operator, like an operator of a car, can adequately steer the thing correctly. This limit switch, I'm concerned that we didn't make it clear enough. The limit switch, according to the code and all experts, say it's for one purpose and one purpose only. It's not intended to limit out the possibility that an operator can hit any fixed object. That's not the intent of the code, and that's not the reason for the rule. The limit switch is, and I analogize it to a fishing rod, maybe not the best analogy, but if you keep cranking a fishing rod and the sinker sticks at the last ring and the pole doesn't bend, if you keep cranking, it snaps the line. That is the danger posed by not having a limit switch. I believe that the experts made it clear that it's to prohibit a catastrophic failure. An operator not paying attention, it goes up as high as this thing will go. It keeps cranking. It breaks the rope or the machinery breaks apart and rains the load down on
people. Well, that's one thing it prevents. Another thing is banging the cab.
My problem may seem very simplistic to you, but it just seems that given the minimal amount of room between the top of the rail car and the bottom of the cab, that it's almost just pure common sense to think that a 12-inch stopping distance is too short. I mean, Crane Pro knew what the setup was, and it also knew that the InfraMetals crew used the crane. So
I can't say it wasn't our job. That may be too simplistic too, except that this 1 foot difference, which I don't know where counsel got that in the record, the distance that it would take, the distance necessary for a load to clear is dependent upon the type of load being pulled out, whether it's one, two, or three plates. I mean, it would change according to the configuration of the scoops put under it.
So I think where they got it is that Crane Pro set the crane to decelerate over a period of 3 seconds, which meant that the crane would continue to move for another 12 inches.
That's true if it were run at full speed. Obviously, the testimony is, and it's clear that an operator had the ability to move that at an infinitely slow speed, could lower a load on a styrofoam cup and not break it. That was the characteristic of the machine. So it wasn't as if somebody was going up and no matter what they did or how they reacted, the thing was going to keep going up 12 inches. Your Honor pointed out that there's an emergency stop that would have stopped this load in the first place.
That emergency stop had no travel in it?
Right.
Hit the emergency stop, it stopped.
Yes, and Mr. Van Til was aware of that.
Tell me, with respect, Mr. Knight, with respect to this switch, does the record make clear whether this switch was to replace the already existing switch or whether it was to be supplementary to that switch? Does the record actually indicate what this new switch
is
supposed to do?
Yes, it does. It is only used in the hoist mode. It is by code because every crane has to have a hoist limit switch for the reasons I stated. It has to have it because this is the catastrophic failure that nobody wants.
The one the plaintiffs say ought to have been on this machine was to replace the one that was already there or to supplement it?
I believe that they're saying that there should have been limit switches in addition to.
That's kind of important, though. I mean, does the record affirmatively tell us whether or not it was supplementary to or replacement for the existing switch?
As much information as we had about other limit switches came from Mr. Williamson, who said, and I'd love to tell you the page because I had it written down. I think it's at page 45 of volume 3. He said you could put other limit switches in, you know, in various ways to keep the load from getting closer to the cab, to keep it from going as high as the cab. And he threw out three or four possibilities that you could put limit switches up there, but he never described how it would be done. Could it be done? Has anybody else done it? Would this crane work to unload rail cars if he did what he thought, in theory, should have been done?
Now, if I may follow up just a moment, you've referred several times to the code. Was the code ever introduced into evidence?
Yes.
It was.
ASME and ANSI. And they have different language, but both of them, and the experts agreed on this part, that the only provision in the code regarding limit switches is to protect against this one catastrophic failure. Otherwise, I think the testimony is clear, and the code surely don't reference setting limit switches to make it impossible for operators to run it into something or somebody or anything else.
Oh, isn't the argument that there was a lack of a limit switch that would have prevented contact with the cab? Isn't that the whole argument?
I don't know if that's the whole argument. I suppose it's theoretically possible to limit this device to lift off the ground a foot if somebody chose to do that. I don't think the record substantiates that could ever be a practical design consideration for a machine like this. But theoretically, yes, it could happen. But in every other circumstance with this type of crane, you have to, you know, allow the operator to control it in such a way that he won't hit fixed objects, which this operator was well aware of. They knew what was the physical layout, and he was able, if he chose, to creep this thing up.
He knew and he knew. Now, is it your view that open and obviousness is an absolute defense?
No.
So it's something to be considered.
It's something that the
court... Now, suppose you had a situation where you have open machinery, very dangerous open machinery. On the other hand, if you're careful, you won't stick your hand in. And suppose that machinery could be shielded at negligible expense by the company, the manufacturer of the machine, so that you couldn't stick your hand in. So in a case like that, would open and obviousness be a defense?
Not anymore. I think you hit it on the head. The old cases that talk about
right.
that mean exactly that.
Well, then why wasn't it for the jury to decide whether this was sufficiently obvious to Van Til to excuse Crane from having failed to take the various precautions that we have discussed?
Because between Judge Moody and Judge Springman, they also held, and really the crux of their rulings were, that there was no showing of the plaintiff's prima facie case that this machine was defective.
But that has nothing... I don't understand all the arguments in the briefs about the open and obvious rule, because you seem to agree it's not an absolute defense, it's just a factor. So you have a bunch of factors here. You have the code, you have the question whether limit switch is feasible, whether they maybe should have removed the cab, or what have you. So why isn't that for a jury to sort out?
Because there wasn't enough expert testimony from the plaintiff to get to the jury the
issue
of defect.
How much expert testimony do you need? I mean, you have this, you know, tight situation with the boxcar and the cab. And one can see there's a danger here, and the question, are there feasible steps to take? I don't know. How much do you need in the way of expert evidence?
More than here, the mere possibility that there's something wrong with this machine that could have been taken care of.
Well, I don't think it's a mere possibility. I mean, just to a lay mind like mine, it seems to me it's pretty dangerous because... of the, you know, this is heavy stuff that's being lifted, and if it hits the cab, it can fall down and do a lot of damage. And there's a paradox with the open and obvious. The danger that's obvious to Van Til was also obvious to Crane, presumably, right?
I would argue otherwise, but for
Well, why for is that? I don't understand. What did Van Til know that you didn't know?
We were there to... There's no testimony that we saw anybody unloading from a boxcar as opposed to another rail car.
You didn't know they unload from boxcars?
I don't think there's any testimony.
Well, I don't understand you. There must be tracks running next to your crane,
right? Oh, sure.
Right?
But there are
what did you think? They didn't unload from a boxcar? What do you think?
No, I'm not saying that. I think the testimony was that there are different kinds of boxcars that come in. Some have no sides. Some have a gondola type that we're dealing with here. It's just different kinds. And we weren't there to assess that situation anyway. We were there to make sure that, you know, it was a machine that could
how
be controlled.
How can you custom design a crane without knowing what kind of surface the crane is going to be lifting things from?
The design of our crane really wouldn't matter what kind of surface we were lifting from. The controls and the way it's controlled wouldn't change based upon what somebody's lifting. It might change the operator's perspective or the operator's obligation, I guess, to steer away from fixed objects.
Don't they tell you when they hire you, crane, I'm not meaning you personally, obviously, but don't they say, crane, you know, we bring in these steel beams on this kind of car, that kind of car, and we need a crane which will lift it out, you know, and put it somewhere else? Don't they say that?
No, there's no testimony of that.
Do you think is a matter of common sense? Wouldn't the crane company be discussing with the plant precisely what is going to be lifted? They'd have to do that, obviously, right?
It
makes a difference than be lifting marshmallows or pig iron, right?
Well, having to do with the capacity of the crane, I would agree. In this case, our individuals talk to InfraMetals, who are, you know, experts at lifting steel or experts at what they need to have happen, and they were pretty specific about what they wanted. They wanted AC controls, like they got the inverter drive. They specified the type of controller to be used, the telemotive controller. So, I don't know. Judge Moody felt that we didn't assume any duty to do anything other than what we did. I don't know if that's what Your Honor is suggesting or not, but I don't think that there's any evidence that we did assume anything other than to produce a machine that was compliant with standards, compliant with good engineering practices, and I don't think there was any testimony to the contrary, that this particular machine was different in type or kind from any other similar machine. Certainly Mr. Williamson didn't provide any information about any other potential alternative designs, whether it be the deceleration speed or distance or the configuration of the crane or the limit switch. He theorized that maybe another limit switch would have fixed this. Judge Springman said, you know, all this is all theory, whether a warning, whether a different design would have changed things, it's all theory. And that's one of the biggest reasons I think she correctly found in our favor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Knight.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Allen, how much time does he have? 5 minutes?
Mr. Allen, could I get a question in?
Yes, sure.
To respond to Mr. Knight, because with respect to a limit switch that would have prevented contact with the cab, I think he's suggesting there was no testimony indicating that it was possible to install such a switch, you know, one that would prevent contact with the cab while at the same time allowing the load to be lifted higher. So what I would be interested in knowing is, was there such evidence? And if not, can Crane Pro be faulted for not installing such a switch?
Your Honor, there was such evidence. Mr. Williamson testified that the defects were threefold. One, they failed to set the limit switch low enough to prevent this contact with the cab. Two, if they felt that restricted them too much or posed a problem some way or another, they could have installed a second limit switch that cost $118 and with installation fees would have been about $500. That would have limited the crane only in the area of the train cars. Three.
When you say a limit switch, this would have been automatic.
The limit switch.
I'm really following up on Judge Ripple's question. So this. There was a button you could press, but what you have in mind would be an automatic.
That's what a limit switch is,
Your Honor. So you'd set it in advance.
Precisely. It's a safety device to keep the load from falling. Excuse me. So the first problem was they didn't set it low enough so that it didn't have a contact. Second, so it didn't contact with the overhead cab. If it would lift so high and then it would stop automatically if they set it at the right height. That's what the second thing they could have done is set a second limit switch, which would have limited the crane's lifting only in the area of the train cars. So if in another part of the plant they wanted to lift higher, they could. Third, they could have removed the cab. Those are the three things that Mr. Williamson testified did not comply with reasonable engineering safety or reasonable engineering practices, and therefore they didn't use due care. It's important that the court realize that the defendants admitted that knowing the material handling processes of the client of InfraMetals was critical. Therefore, they sent people to the plant to observe the processes, Mr. Pratrito, Mr. Spencer, who testified specifically that he saw the spreader bars being used, and Mr. Laughlin, their expert, also admitted these facts. So the use of the spreader bar was well known. So was the difficulties that these operators were having. Had more than 100 failures. This was the third of three cranes that was installed. This crane was in service for only 10 days. But with the other two cranes that they installed, they had over 100 overload failures, and they knew that they had reason to know that the operators were having difficulties managing all these tasks and with the controls.
And Mr. Knight said there was no actual evidence about this 1 foot spread between the boxcar rim and the cab.
I respectfully disagree. Mr. Mesman testified. I believe several witnesses testified. It was about a foot.
About a
foot. And the point is, if reasonable engineering practices had been followed here, which were laid out by Mr. Williamson, what you do when you reconstruct or design a crane like this, if you had followed these practices, find out what the material handling processes are, what are the hazards involved, and design against those hazards if it's economically and technologically feasible. If those things would have been done, we wouldn't be here. But they weren't done, and that's why the load fell. I suppose I didn't need to talk so fast, and I apologize for that. But I think the important point, finally, is this court got it right in Trailer versus Husqvarna, when the court said that the open and obvious defense was abolished by the legislature's changes in the act and replaced with incurred risk. Incurred risk is requires a state of venturousness. John Mesman was asked, did he think it was dangerous? His answer was no, it was the usual job procedure. It was normal work procedure. He thought he was just doing his job the way he was instructed in as safe a fashion as possible, and he didn't appreciate the harm that he was exposed to. But the defendants did, and they could have prevented it with an expenditure of less than $500. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel.